WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
In his own farewell address, George Washington wrote that self-government is the underpinning of our safety, prosperity, and liberty. But from different causes and from different quarters, much pains will be taken to weaken in your minds the conviction of this truth. And so we have to preserve this truth with jealous anxiety that we should reject the first dawning of every attempt to alienate any portion of our country from the rest, or to enfeeble the sacred ties that make us one.
That was President Obama from his farewell address last night, invoking George Washington from his. And like Washington's, Obama's was kind of a warning about the state of our democracy and whether we can maintain it. It was also an expression of faith in his original message of hope and change.
So that faith that I placed all those years ago, not far from here, in the power of ordinary Americans to bring about change, that faith has been rewarded in ways I could not have possibly imagined. And I hope your faith has too.
And good morning, everyone. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And because of the flow of events, today's program will wind up as kind of a contrast between the outgoing president of the United States and the incoming one. We'll play probably four more clips from the Obama farewell address with no guests. You're the guests. We'll take your calls on some of the president's words from last night and other things you might want to say. And then at 11 o'clock, Donald Trump is scheduled to hold his first news conference as president-elect, and we will bring you that live. On the Obama speech, some of the questions I have for you, if you watched it, are: how concerned are you about the fragility of American democracy? Do you think he was right to give it to everyone, his supporters as well as Republicans or conservatives, for being stuck in our self-reinforcing bubbles? Was he too self-congratulatory in identifying progress? And was he too hopeful or appropriately hopeful? Like in the clip we just heard, he did express this ongoing faith in American culture and institutions and people, despite so many of his supporters losing some faith after seeing so many Americans willing to vote for Donald Trump. He said his faith in the power of ordinary Americans to bring about change has been rewarded. I hope yours has too, he said. So call in and tell us if it has. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Our next excerpt from the speech is about 3.5 minutes. We've thinned out some of the applause here, just so you know. He's getting a lot of applause last night in Chicago, but we don't want to take up a lot of time with that. We do want to acknowledge that he got the applause. But our next excerpt from the speech is this basic framing of the challenges to our democracy that Obama sees despite our nation's enduring strengths.
To begin with, our democracy won't work without a sense that everyone has economic opportunity. And the good news is that today the economy is growing again. Wages, incomes, home values, and retirement accounts are all rising again. Poverty is falling again. The wealthy are paying a fair share of taxes, even as the stock market shatters records. The unemployment rate is near a 10-year low. The uninsured rate has never, ever been lower. Healthcare costs are rising at the slowest rate in 50 years. And I've said, and I mean it, if anyone can put together a plan that is demonstrably better, than the improvements we've made to our healthcare system that covers as many people at less cost, I will publicly support it. Because that, after all, is why we serve. Not to score points or take credit, but to make people's lives better. But for all the real progress that we've made, we know it's not enough. Our economy doesn't work as well or grow as fast when a few prosper at the expense of a growing middle class and ladders for folks who want to get into the middle class. That's the economic argument, but stark inequality is also corrosive to our democratic idea. While the top 1% has amassed a bigger share of wealth and income, too many of our families in inner cities and in rural counties have been left behind. The laid-off factory worker, the waitress or healthcare worker who's just barely getting by and struggling to pay the bills, convinced that the game is fixed against them, that their government only serves the interests of the powerful. That's a recipe for more cynicism and polarization in our politics. Now, there are no quick fixes to this long-term trend. I agree, our trade should be fair and not just free. But the next wave of economic dislocations won't come from overseas. It will come from the relentless pace of automation that makes a lot of good middle-class jobs obsolete. And so we're going to have to forge a new social compact to guarantee all our kids the education they need, to give workers the power to unionize for better wages, to update the social safety net to reflect the way we live now, and make more reforms to the tax code so corporations and individuals who reap the most from this new economy don't avoid their obligations to the country that's made their very success possible. We can argue about how to best achieve these goals, but we can't be complacent about the goals themselves. For if we don't create opportunity for all people, the disaffection and division that has stalled our progress will only sharpen in years to come.
President Obama from his farewell address. And listeners, I wanted to play that clip because so much is being made in the media about his knock on being in our bubbles, which we will play in a minute and which is important, but it's getting so much attention because everyone loves to hear about social media and identity politics these days that I think it got lost that the first challenge to democracy that he framed was that we just played, economic inequality. So there was what he said about that. Now we'll get to the identity bubbles part of the speech and how he kind of blames everybody for it, not just Republicans and conservatives. It doesn't need any more setup than that, so here it is, and then we'll take some of your calls.
Our youth, our drive, our diversity and openness, our boundless capacity for risk and reinvention means that the future should be ours. But that potential will only be realized if our democracy works. Only if our politics better reflects the decency of our people. Only if all of us, regardless of party affiliation or particular interests, help restore the sense of common purpose that we so badly need right now. And that's what I want to focus on tonight, the state of our democracy.
All right, that was kind of a prelude to the part about race and identity politics and being in our own bubbles, and here's the payoff.
There's a second threat to our democracy, and this one is as old as our nation itself. After my election, there was talk of a post-racial America. And such a vision, however well-intended, was never realistic. Race remains a potent and often divisive force in our society. Now, I've lived long enough to know that race relations are better than they were 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, no matter what some folks say. You can see it not just in statistics. You see it in the attitudes of young Americans across the political spectrum. But we're not where we need to be. And all of us have more work to do. If every economic issue is framed as a struggle between a hardworking white middle class and an undeserving minority, then workers of all shades are going to be left fighting for scraps while the wealthy withdraw further into their private enclaves. If we're unwilling to invest in the children of immigrants just because they don't look like us, we will diminish the prospects of our own children, because those brown kids will represent a larger and larger share of America's workforce. And we have shown that our economy doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. Last year, incomes rose for all races, all age groups, for men and for women. So if we're going to be serious about race going forward, we need to uphold laws against discrimination in hiring and in housing and in education and in the criminal justice system. That is what our Constitution and our highest ideals require. But laws alone won't be enough. Hearts must change. They won't change overnight. Social attitudes oftentimes take generations to change. But if our democracy is to work the way it should in this increasingly diverse nation, then each one of us need to try to heed the advice of a great character in American fiction, Atticus Finch, who said, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it." For blacks and other minority groups, that means tying our own very real struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in this country face. Not only the refugee or the immigrant or the rural poor or the transgender American, but also the middle-aged white guy who, from the outside, may seem like he's got advantages, but has seen his world upended by economic and cultural and technological change. We have to pay attention and listen. For white Americans, it means acknowledging that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s. That when minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness. When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised for native-born Americans. For native-born Americans, it means reminding ourselves that the stereotypes about immigrants today were said almost word for word about the Irish and Italians and Poles, who it was said were going to destroy the fundamental character of America. And as it turned out, America wasn't weakened by the presence of these newcomers. These newcomers embraced this nation's creed, and this nation was strengthened.
President Obama from his farewell address, and we'll hear more from the speech still. But now let's hear from you. How concerned are you about the fragility of American democracy? Do you think he was right to give it to everyone, as he did in that centerpiece clip, his supporters as well as Republicans or conservatives, for being stuck in our self-reinforcing bubbles? Was he too self-congratulatory in identifying progress? And was he too hopeful? He did express that ongoing faith in American culture and institutions, despite so many of his supporters losing some faith after seeing so many Americans willing to vote for Donald Trump. Call in and answer any of these questions or respond to the farewell address in whatever way at 212-433-WNYC. And we'll start with Narda in Inwood. Hi, Narda. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I thought his message was right on point. it was what so many of us needed to hear, especially after, well, especially with the prospect of what's coming. The biggest takeaway to me was that elections, we cannot get involved only every 4 years. We have to get involved regularly and stay involved and be vigilant and call
in politics in general, not just in elections. Yeah,
that's right.
And that's the clip that we have yet to play. Yeah, that was the end of the speech.
Exactly. And just become better citizens. I mean, I feel that he wasn't congratulatory enough during his presidency. And this was a great summary of, look, this is everything I've done, and I've made the country better for everyone, not just for people who supported me, but for everyone.
How about his imploring everybody to get out of their own bubbles, including his supporters? As someone who just said, you said, you know, you're kind of dreading what's coming in. Do you think there's all, like the clip we just heard when he said, it means tying our own struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in the country face, also the middle-aged white man who from the outside may seem like he's got all the advantages, but who's seen his world upended, et cetera. What'd you think about that part?
I thought he was right on the money. He was absolutely right, because for too many of us, And I'm guilty of this as well. We want to hear things that are just going to further our candidate and make, you know, and support those ideas. There are things that, and I refuse to say his name, but, you know, there are things that I kind of do agree. Like, let's limit term limits for Congress people and people in the Senate. You know, let's have term limits. So, yes, let's get away and let's come together. And yes, we may not agree on everything, but it's important for us, if we're going to move ahead as a country, to support all ideas and not be stuck in our own world and just support stories that that we agree with.
Narda, thank you so much for starting us off. Chris in Garden City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. My concern was that, again, I agree with the last caller there. I thought everything was on point, and I thought it was a very good speech. But I just felt that the whole choice of the venue and the atmosphere contradicted the basic content of the speech, which is that we have put ourselves in these bubbles, to self-fulfilling bubbles that just keep pushing our own groups. And I can only imagine what that white middle-aged, you know, that middle-aged white guy who does blame Obama on everything, who maybe wanted to listen, you know, give the speech a chance, probably would have turned it off just before he even spoke a word, with the adoration and all the cheering and everything that occurred.
It was different from recent presidential farewell addresses, in that it was given in a public setting like this rather than from the White House. If I'm not mistaken, the last few have been in that setting, and they were presidential speeches in that respect, not campaign style, as you say. 20,000 people there in Chicago last night. I think from his perspective, it was kind of, you know, tying a bow on where he had come from, and the kickoff to his campaign originally, also I think the 2012 reelection acceptance speech was in Chicago, and then come home to the city on the mainland, at least, where he's kind of from. But you thought that inadvertently or not, sent an us and them message.
Correct. I mean, the way I look at it is, for the next, and I will say 8 years, I feel like, you know, whenever our next president will give speeches, I'm already going to have a very frustrated feeling before a speech. And the last thing I'm going to want to see, and I can guarantee you, those speeches are going to be done in a very, very positive environment and atmosphere with lots of adoring fans, and that's even going to irk me more.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only imagine that's what's happening last night to those, you know, to the people that truly hate Obama, and that he definitely probably wanted to get that message across to those people.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. Margarita in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Margarita.
Hi. I really love the tone of his speech. I think he was preparing all of us for the times ahead. The lack of ethical principle of the president-elect is amazing. Even before winning the presidency, he was claiming the election was rigged, and he probably will not accept if Hillary won. If you don't accept the rules of an election, this is already a matter for impeachment. He was not he already declared that everything was rigged, and he won. So he lied, he bullied, he mocked. We are going to have times ahead that are really depressing for people that believe in democracy.
So it sounds like you are
really alert us that we all have to participate in, you know, upheld these principles.
We have to participate, or our democracy is threatened. Here's another minute and a half or so clip where he reinforces this part about being in our own bubbles and talks about a common baseline of facts and a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point sometimes is too missing from our democracy, from our politics. Here's a little more of the president from his farewell address.
For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And the rise of naked partisanship and increasing economic and regional stratification, the splintering of our media into a channel for every taste. All this makes this great sorting seem natural, even inevitable. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. And this trend represents a third threat to our democracy. Look, politics is a battle of ideas. That's how our democracy was designed. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information, and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, and that science and reason matter, then we're going to keep talking past each other, and we'll make common ground and compromise impossible.
More of President Obama from his farewell address, more of your reactions. Peter in Suffolk County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I thought the speech, he did try and reach out. You know, I thought he always has. But, you know, you walk away and you think about what was said. I disagree with some of the points. I think, you know, that white, you know, man, feel pity for him. I didn't appreciate that. It made me feel like the poster at the airport that used to profile the drug dealer with the Ray-Bans and the jean jacket and the cowboy boots. I think it's a little more involved than that. And, you know, everybody likes to quote Atticus Finch, and I read the book, but I have not had anyone ask me for my shoes, you know. I think he kind of generalized the fears. It harkened back to his 2008, you know, when he was elected, and he gave his State of the Union address back then, how, you know, how we got, you know, it's all about the economy, and we're all in it together. I see the world going nowhere but back into the bubbles and into their own respective corners.
So
that scares me.
Yeah, it scares you for our democracy and for who we are as a people. What did you mean? And for the world, I hear you. What did you mean when you said that thing about the Ray-Bans and the drug dealers?
Yeah.
The way he was
in the 70s, they had a poster in the airports. You know, if you see this reported, and it was a picture of like a, I'm going to paraphrase now and get show my bad side, but it looked like a guy that would be from Florida with Ray-Bans and a cowboy hat and an alligator hat band, and cowboy boots and jeans, and that was, you know, they said, like, this is the drug dealer. Look for this guy. He's the guy that's got money in his boots, and he's carrying pot from, you know, Central America or whatever.
And you thought how he kind of portrayed the you know, underemployed white male?
Yeah. Yeah, I do, because I fit those characteristics that he's described, but my mental attitude and anything else doesn't fit any of that. Mm-hmm. I don't resent the people that I see, you know, they're taking my jobs. I'm not that kind of guy. You know what? I think people are giving them jobs, and I question who's giving them the jobs. Because if you could hire me for twice the money, or you could hire two people, the person that's running the business is going to hire two people. Doesn't matter if he's black, yellow, green, blue, doesn't matter. As far as everybody retreating into their neighborhoods, you know, when you only have a certain economic ladder to choose, then that's the neighborhood you're left to live in. I live amongst immigrants. I live in a very heavily diverse neighborhood, but mm-hmm. not too many white people. I could say I'm the only white guy on my block. It's like the Kink song. But I think that he kind of generalized it, and I don't have fear of the other people. I'm kind mm-hmm. of mad at my contemporaries who, mm-hmm. rather than hire me, they decided, or, you know, sometimes often don't have even the same skills, but what they've managed to do is become a boss.
Yeah.
And they've hired people, and
right.
then the government promotes that, because now
right.
he's an entrepreneur.
And then you're saying don't blame the immigrants, blame the employers, but still you feel that the president was stigmatizing white guys in that reference. Peter, thank you very much. I really appreciate you checking in. Here's Satya in Marlboro.
Yeah.
You're on WNYC. Hello, Satya.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I didn't listen to the Obama speech completely, but I heard some clips. But from what I understand, his speech seems to suggest that with the Trump administration, immigrants are somehow less welcome to this country. I am an immigrant to this country. I'm also an organizer of All-American Rally for Trump at Liberty Bell in Philadelphia at allamericanrallyfortrump.com, where we brought in Chinese, Hispanics, Blacks, Whites, Haitians. You name it, we have, including Muslims, we have brought them all together to stand up, to say what Trump stands for, and to demonstrate that it is not just a white community. And I think Obama is a good man, but he's engaging in a pure demagoguery. He's a lost leftist liberal. For him to say things like that, I think it is not a good thing.
What did he say that you felt offended by, or that wasn't unifying as he was trying to communicate it, it seems?
The clip I saw, he was telling about this is a country where immigrants are always welcome. How did that change? Just because Trump is coming, he's going to make it less welcome?
Well, you know what Trump has said about Mexican...
Trump has said about illegal immigrants. He didn't say anything about legal immigrants.
He did say that specifically about Mexicans who are here illegally, in, you know, contrary to the facts, to what we know about the statistics of who commits rapes and murders and other violent crimes at what rate. There isn't really the data to back up the idea that Mexicans who are here illegally commit violent crimes at higher rates than native-born Americans. And
I said it's okay.
Pardon me?
No, that's fine. I mean, whether they are high or low, if there are illegal immigrants who are committing crime and on the citizens or people here who are legally, then we have a responsibility to let them go. I don't see why following the law is a problem here. And why is it as viewed as an immigrant versus non-immigrant issue? And
mm-hmm.
this is playing to the politics, it looks to me.
And when he announced... from a text that he wrote and read from last December, that I, Donald Trump, proposed to ban all Muslims from entering the country. Was that not?
Yeah, okay. I can tell you there are 60 Islamic countries in the world today. And I know, I work with people in Bangladesh and Pakistan, and where in Pakistan there were 23% Hindus and Sikhs. Within 60 years, it has been reduced to 1%. In Bangladesh, there are 30% of Hindus in 1947. Today, there are 7%. There are 60 Islamic countries in the world, and I'm naming, and I, please correct me if I'm wrong, not a single Islamic country gives equal rights to non-Muslims. So there is something in their ideology that separates them, that will put discriminates against non-Muslims.
I don't know if that's true or not in terms of those national governments, but what effect should that have on U.S. immigration policy?
Yes, because he said we have to vet them. Today, the polls, some polls said about the Muslim Americans, who said the large number of them believe in Sharia law. They believe in non-equal rights. I mean, women have to be treated in a certain manner.
And you don't want individuals treated as individuals rather than lumped in as a group, Muslims, because there's some survey somewhere?
No, I have Muslim friends. They're really wonderful people. I'm not saying against that. What I'm saying is we as a country have a responsibility. If this is showing, the statistics are showing, the reviews, the polls are showing that they believe in a completely different ideology. In the mosques they are teaching, I have seen mosques teaching, quoting from Quran, that very, very negative verses about the mainstream. There are people in the mosque teaching that against anti-constitutional. They don't believe in U.S. Constitution. We have seen what is going on in Europe.
And Satya, I'm going to leave it there, and I appreciate your call very much. And we go next to Bob in Morristown. Bob, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
I was disappointed in that the president continued his unifying rhetoric, but without identifying those people who have actively plotted to destroy not only his presidency, but the underpinnings of our democracy. He seems to think that there is a way to reach out to the Trump supporters and the Trumps of the world to bring them under this big tent. And my experience in politics and in my social life and reading the social media is that this is not possible. These people do not live in the same world we do. They believe Hillary Clinton stole millions of dollars from the Haitian relief funds in order to enrich herself. They believe Bill Clinton committed dozens of rapes while he was governor and while he was president. Their world is comprised of a vile, filthy fantasy that is destructive, and they will not listen to any other point.
Some Trump voters believe that, all that stuff. But therefore what?
Therefore, we have to organize, we have to make sure we get our votes out, and we have to beat them at the polls.
Right. But in terms of criticizing the president's farewell address last night, was he supposed to single out those individuals who fit that conspiracy theory mold?
Not individuals, but the entire Republican Party has, starting with Mitch McConnell's comment in 2008, the day that the president was sworn in, that said we're going to work very hard to make sure he's a one-term president. They have done everything they can, including sub rosa cooperation with the Russians, to hurt his presidency, and by that, hurt the country. And I think that needs to be called out. These people have committed acts that would not have been tolerated by their own party 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Bob, thank you very much. So here's one more clip from the president's farewell address, and it's two big thoughts. One of the callers earlier brought up the first of these already. As he's done since his election, he calls on Americans to take democracy into your own hands. If democracy is threatened, which was the theme of his speech, don't just throw brickbats on Twitter. Get out there. And he expresses his belief that despite reasons for pessimism today, America did make progress during his 8 years in office. If the theme was hope and change, you should still have hope because change did come. See what you think.
It falls to each of us to be those anxious, jealous guardians of our democracy, to embrace the joyous task we've been given to continually try to improve this great nation of ours. Because for all our outward differences, we in fact all share the same proud title. the most important office in a democracy. Citizen. Citizen. So you see, that's what our democracy demands. It needs you. Not just when there's an election, not just when your own narrow interest is at stake, but over the full span of a lifetime. If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life. If something needs fixing, then lace up your shoes and do some organizing. If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself. Show up. Dive in. Stay at it. Sometimes you'll win. Sometimes you'll lose. Presuming a reservoir of goodness in other people, that can be a risk. And there will be times when the process will disappoint you. But for those of us fortunate enough to have been part of this work and to see it up close, let me tell you, it can energize and inspire. And more often than not, your faith in America and in Americans will be confirmed. Mine sure has been. Over the course of these 8 years, I've seen the hopeful faces of young graduates and our newest military officers. I have mourned with grieving families, searching for answers, and found grace in Charleston Church. I've seen our scientists help a paralyzed man regain his sense of touch. I've seen wounded warriors who at points were given up for dead walk again. I've seen our doctors and volunteers rebuild after earthquakes and stop pandemics in their tracks. I've seen the youngest of children remind us through their actions and through their generosity of our obligations to care for refugees or work for peace. And above all, to look out for each other. So that faith that I placed all those years ago, not far from here, in the power of ordinary Americans to bring about change, that faith has been rewarded in ways I could not have possibly imagined. And I hope your faith has too.
President Obama, from his farewell address, his faith in the power of ordinary Americans to bring about change has been rewarded. I hope yours has too, he said. Tell us if it has. We've got about 2 minutes left in the segment. Let's see if we can get four 30-second comments in here, starting with Javier in Westchester. Javier, you got 30 seconds. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Lehrer. First-time caller, long-time listener.
I guess my
main feeling about it is I was kind of feeling like wondering, you know, why wasn't this call to action and call to act displayed in the early days of the administration? I feel like, you know, where was that urgency, you know, when it came to, you know, financial reform, health care? I kind of felt like, you know, it was mainly a job done in Washington, and that, you know, the fact that we had to address those issues now makes it obvious that, you know, he didn't address it as president of the United States.
And Javier, I'm going to leave it there. Please call us again. Marie in Carroll Gardens, you're on the air. Hi, Marie.
Brian, what a pleasure. The biggest takeaway for me was that you got to stop taking people who you disagree with out of your Facebook news feeds, because that doesn't help you expand your mind. You got to sit and have a conversation with them, because that's what's going to move this country forward. I'm so glad that he focused on that, because I wish that Hillary had done it. Maybe she would have won.
Thank you, Marie. Zoban on Staten Island. Hi, Zoban.
Good morning, Brian. I just want to say the election, the taking over of the government by the Republicans is going to usher in a decline of morality in government. These people have no concept as to how to govern.
Talk about, for today, talk about Obama's farewell address.
Oh, okay. Well, then here's what I want to say then. Then I'm going to touch on the last caller. If he is questioning the urgency of Mr. Obama's speech last night, then I want to say to him he wasn't listening. Because from the very day this man came in, the urgency was there. He carried on out. He just wasn't paying attention, or maybe he was stuck up in his own bubble. But the urgency was always there. Always. And I just want to...
You're telling the previous caller, Javier, that Obama always did have the urgency. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The urgency was always there. He always had it. But look at the people that he had to deal with in implementing these urgencies. The power is the Republican vow that will make sure he failed as president.
Yes. Zoban, thank you very much. And Daniel in Woodbridge, you're on the air. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Brian, just real quick, love the speech. We've never questioned whether or not President Obama was a great speechmaker, but especially the part on race, I loved it, but I felt, you know, similar to Javier's comment, it was a little too little too late. You're now waiting till you're going out the door to tell, you know, white people that they need to, you know, listen to the protests of people of color. It's not just political correctness, and reminding Poles, Italians, and other immigrant groups that you weren't always accepted as white, and now you're turning around and hating on immigrants. I love that part of the speech. I thought it was brilliant, but it's like, why didn't you say this last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, eight years ago? You're saying this now? It just came across as too little, too late.
Daniel, thank you very much. And thanks to all of you who called. That's our coverage of President Obama's farewell address, with you as the guests responding to the excerpts. Thank you all for your participation. Coming up next, we'll hear briefly what Governor Cuomo had to say specifically to Westchester and Long Island in the two regional State of the State addresses he gave in the New York suburbs yesterday. And then we'll have live coverage of Donald Trump's first news conference as president-elect. And in a way, he set up this morning to be a contrast, because after President Obama scheduled his farewell address for last night, Trump scheduled his first news conference for this morning, and we will have it live at 11. Stay with us.